If I have a legacy, I'd like to be able to say that I helped build a bridge for parents, for coaches, for teachers, to understand that sport is not about just winning and being famous and all the things. I've had so many famous people in my life who regret becoming famous. They would much rather have been anonymous and developed a sense of priority and becoming the kind of person they wanted to become, and then have the success they have, but it's actually through a very special kind of lens that gives them a sense of peace about it. And so I would hope my legacy would be that I helped open the door a little wider for people to understand that sport is simply an opportunity to learn lessons about life that is, it's invaluable, it's a priceless, but you have to see it in that context.
Hello, my friends. This is Nishant, and welcome to another episode of the Nishant Garg Show. This show is for people who want to live a life of excellence, love, and joy, and my mission is to bring awareness about transformation and life skills. And my job on this show is to invite the world-class experts to deconstruct their practices, routines, and habits to help you live a fulfilled and abundant life. And today's guest is Dr. Jim Lehrer. Dr. Jim is a world-renowned performance psychologist whose groundbreaking science-based energy management training system has achieved worldwide recognition. Dr. Jim has worked with hundreds of world-class performers from the arenas of sport, business, medicine, and law enforcement, including Fortune 100 executives, FBI hostage rescue teams, and military special forces. He is the author of 17 books, including his most recent, Leading with Character, which also comes with the Personal Credo Journal, a companion to Leading with Character. He also co-authored the national bestseller, The Power of Full Engagement. And please enjoy this wide-ranging conversation with Dr. Jim. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Nishant. I'm very excited to be with you, and I hope we can create some value for your listeners.
I am so excited to be with you. And before we get started, I want to tell all the listeners that I read Jim's book, The Power of Full Engagement, about 4 years ago. And this book, The Power of Full Engagement, has made so much amazing things in my life throughout the productivity, how to manage time, which you cannot manage. That's what you describe in your work, how we can manage our energy in terms of physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. So, Jim, I want to start with a simple question. What is your favorite sport?
My favorite sport is tennis. I started out in baseball. I played 9 years of baseball, and then I was a pitcher, and I hurt my arm, and I was never able to play again. We didn't know in those days how many throws a young player can execute without damaging the muscles of their arm. And now they count the number of pitches. But that was the end of my baseball career. Then I played basketball, became a pretty decent basketball player. And then I took up tennis. And tennis, I just fell in love with tennis and have played tennis my entire lifetime. And that's I love all kinds of hiking and outdoor sports, and I think sport is a wonderful opportunity to learn how our system works, how our mind and body connect. For me, tennis was the nugget that I will always be grateful for, and I will play until I can't play anymore.
At what age did you start playing tennis?
I didn't pick up tennis until later because I played most of my young years were in baseball and basketball. I was about 13 or 14 years of age when I picked up tennis, and my father played tennis. He was an outstanding athlete. He was basically a professional baseball player, and that's how I got involved in baseball. And I played high school tennis and college tennis, and and then went on and, you know, became very involved in coaching and teaching tennis and in helping to bring sports science to the world. I was the founding director of sports science for the United States Tennis Association and tried to bring a sports science perspective to the coaching and teaching of tennis. And so I've had a love affair with tennis my entire life, and it's been a great learning opportunity for me in so many ways.
What have you learned? I'm just curious, what have you learned in the game of tennis?
Well, when I wrote my first book, it was called Mental Toughness Training for Sports, and I was actively involved in tennis. A lot of what I wrote about, because I was involved heavily in competition, I love competitive tennis and playing tournaments and traveling and doing all the things that you can do, really helped me understand at a deeper level something that I came to refer to as one's ideal performance state, and was later kind of named flow by the brilliant psychologist at the University of Chicago, Csikszentmihalyi, and I learned a lot of the work that I ultimately did in sport through the realm of tennis. I started working with professional tennis players, and I sampled 23 different sports and asked them to describe what they felt like when they were performing at their absolute best. And whether it was football or professional hockey or, you know, individual sports like tennis and golf. And I was shocked to learn that we all use pretty much the same words to describe this very special mind-body union where we'd become lost in a sense in what we are doing, that what we are doing and where we are in terms of our mind become one, that the action and the doing become so unified, they're almost inseparable. And tennis was a great resource for me to kind of apply it in my own life as I was competing and as I was also working with a number of professional athletes, mostly in tennis, but I began to work in all sports and applying this concept of the ideal performance state. And it was extremely helpful to me. It was my most popular book for many, many years. And it was simply out of these interviews that I did over 3 years and then put all that data together. And I think it was the first time anyone had ever really looked at that there was this special mind-body balance that has to occur. It's physical, it's emotional, it's mental. And I came to later understand that it was also spiritual and that it's acquired. You don't just wake up in the morning and decide you're going to be really a great competitor. It's a lot of hard work, and the mind is very complicated. The body and the connections that we have to our skill levels and to this magnificent neural operating center between our ears, to get it all to function in a highly competitive arena and to do it on demand is quite intriguing to me, and I'm still pursuing more of an understanding, certainly from a neuroscience perspective, how can we get to this ignition point between what we can do and what we are actually doing in the heat of battle?
You mentioned about a spiritual balance. So, Jim, do you have any spiritual practice on a regular basis?
You know, it's a great question. I really, as a psychologist, I really had no training at all. I was trained to work with people who had, you know, emotional and mental illnesses. I became chief psychologist and executive director of a very large community mental health center that served the whole central and southern part of Colorado. We had 9 offices and we covered an 8,600 square mile catchment area. And I really became, you know, excited about applying psychology, not just to people who are suffering from illness or sickness, but applying psychology to helping really ordinary people become extraordinary. and to try to look at the application. And at that time, this was back in the 70s. No one was doing that. And this was an idea inspired in me by an exercise, brilliant exercise physiologist by the name of Dr. Joe Vigil, who was a legend in track and field and a legend in the Olympics. And he said, Jim, this is going to be a really big field. And you're kind of a pioneer. You love to do new things. And he said, I'd really push you. So I worked with his runners and I worked with tennis players. And eventually I decided to make this my career, where I would try to learn as much as I could about this incredible connection between mind and body. And I became involved in meditation, thinking that might be an answer. And that was a part of an answer. I became involved in, but none of my training, I was no training whatsoever involved in meditation or even in the context of visualization and imagery rehearsal and all of those kinds of things. That all came later in my pursuit of my own competence in helping people achieve the best they could possibly achieve in a competitive arena. So today I love various forms of, I call this my spiritual practice, kind of a meditation on gratefulness, a meditation on kindness, on, you know, really crystallizing the people that have been so important in my life, and to really understand the importance of their guidance in my life and to focus on that. And I have come to really appreciate what I would call the spiritual dimension in myself and in others. Even though I'm more of a research and data guy, there is something so special there. And so the last 10 years of my life, I was involved in collecting data. We had at the Human Performance Institute, which I co-founded with Dr. Jack Groppel, who had his PhD in bioengineering. Probably today, some 400,000 people have gone through that 2.5-day program. And I mean, we are data crazy. I still have boxes of data that we collected, and we measured everything we could. We had an incredible 9-acre facility that in almost every conceivable kind of high-level performance participant was there, from professional sport, military, special forces. We even had sumo wrestlers from Japan. We had elite hostage rescue teams, all kinds of surgeons, surgical teams, nurses from all kinds of applications in health and then in the corporate world, what we called corporate athletes. And all that data over time began to lead us to the conclusion that sustained success was really a function of the spiritual dimension. And I really refer to that as the character, mostly the character, who you are in terms of your treatment of other people, your honesty, your integrity, your kindness, your compassion for others, your gratefulness, your humility. And I never learned any of these things in my training as a psychologist. So what happened was this data kept pushing that you can scale the mountain of success and have virtually none of those in your portfolio of assets. But if you want to sustain success, you can't walk over dead bodies and sustain that incredible positioning at the top of the mountain that you've just scaled, because people really are not that connected to you and they don't really enjoy your success. You really haven't built this support around you that really wants to enable you to continue your success. So the last 10 years of my life were devoted to understanding how do you build those assets and how do you do it in a way that doesn't sound kind of hocus pocus and doesn't get us into, you know, different kinds of religious thinking, although a lot of this actually is deeply embedded in religious thought. I wanted to kind of rise above, and whether you're a religious person or not, you have an understanding and appreciation for the spiritual dimension of who we are. And I define that as, you know, the spiritual dimension is the energy associated with the human spirit. And that spirit is connected to other people and how you interact, treat, how you appreciate the importance of other people in your life, because without them, probably nothing would have happened in your life. All of life is a gift, but even people who didn't treat you well taught you important lessons. And so I've tried to incorporate the best of those practices in my life, and I'm still searching to find more and better ways. What we learned was that the highest level of health is spiritual health. And that it reverberates across physical health, emotional health, mental health as well. And you can't really separate them distinctly. And you, when you do that, you know, our system is fully integrated. You can't pry things apart. That's the problem in medicine. When you get too specialized, you don't see the whole dynamic. And everything changes in its relationship to everything else. So we try not to create these distinct categories without understanding this is a fully integrated, multidimensional system that cannot be torn apart unless and until you understand its connection to all other dimensions in the system. So it's a Rubik cube that just keeps unfolding. But I'm not sure there'll ever be a complete solution, but I really have come to admire this brilliance in how the system was designed. And probably the biggest takeaway, and this was I started with Dr. Jack Groppel, the company in 1992, which is, seems like a long, long time ago. And we were very, very, so we had probably the most extraordinary faculty that I could have possibly imagine ever collecting there at the Institute. We had a former commander of the SEALs as an instructor, the former commander of the Blue Angels. We had Air Force fighter pilots. We had all kinds of people who had demonstrated an unbelievable ability to complete a mission, to do things that almost no one believed could be done. And we all learned from them, but we all were on a journey to try to build a better understanding of how the system can be trained. And I'm into training. I really believe that's, we've got, system is a remarkably malleable system that if you put the right inputs in, you'll get the right outputs. But the most important conclusion that we came to, which is so simple, which seems so ridiculously obvious, after all we did, after all those years, was our bottom line was that health ignites performance, and that we were really in the health business. We were simply helping people get healthier physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually. And in doing that, they perform better and they were able to sustain their performance over long periods of time.
I have so many questions over here. If you had known about a spiritual dimension in your work about 20, 30 years ago, do you think you could have trained athletes in different ways?
I mean, I always look back and I always say, I wish I had known when I started what took 35 or 40 years to learn. I would have done things differently. I would have set up the model more quickly, and I would have changed a lot of what I was doing as a performance psychologist, because it took years for me. I'm kind of a hard-nosed science guy, and I never, you know, when I look at where I ended up, I have to pinch myself, because it's like, how did I end up here having such reverence for this particular dimension of being human? And, you know, we started the Human Performance Institute. What we were all about was getting people to achieve great things under pressure and not to fail. And to do this from a science-based exercise physiology, the finest nutritionists we could find anywhere, finest exercise physiologists, the finest people who specialized in all of the different aspects, neuroscience, and to bring all of that together in the service of helping people achieve things they never thought they could. But that's why I have to pinch myself and I say, well, we ended up as the single most important dimension of health was something we called spiritual. And I think that was the first, I think the article that I co-authored in the Harvard Business Review entitled On Becoming a Corporate Athlete was the first time the word spiritual had ever been allowed in the Harvard Business Review. But we defined it in a way they were comfortable. Now it ends up everybody's, you know, very comfortable with it. But it took years. So, you know, long answer to the question. I wish I had known much sooner, but I had to go through this. There's no way I could have gotten there. You couldn't have convinced me in a conversation. I had to experience it and I had to see the data.
That is very true. You have worked with many different clients in baseball, football, golf, medicine, military. And when you didn't have a spiritual dimension, what practices did you suggest to your clients in the past to perform under high stress situations?
The single most important element in a person's life is what I would call their purpose for living. And that's where the spiritual dimension is brought full circle. When man developed this extraordinary ability for this conscious awareness that we are can actually ask the question, why are we here? What is this all about? The deer or any of the subhuman species, they have awareness, but they're not aware that they're going to die. They're not aware that this is not whatever state they're in. They just assume it's going to continue forever. They have no understanding that it will one day end. And this notion, this understanding of what is sometimes referred to as existential angst, we realize that this will one day end for us. And so the first question is, why was I born? What am I doing here? What am I supposed to do with this thing we call life? Because one day it will end and it could end tomorrow. And so the whole question of the meaning of life, what do we want to devote our life to? And where will this end up taking us under our own direction, if that's possible? You know, that opens the door to the spiritual dimension. And from there, you go to, well, what are your values? What do you believe? What must happen for you to consider yourself to have been a success and worthy of this extraordinary gift of life? What might be referred to as your ultimate mission in life, the mission for which failure is not an option? If you, in fact, are going to determine that you were worthy of this gift and that you really had a life of success, enduring success. And what happens when people get into that space? It inevitably takes them back to other people. And that's how we got to this notion that the spiritual dimension is the highest level is defined by your treatment of others. And what you ultimately begin to realize that your life was never about you. You had no control over the fact that you were born. You just showed up. You made the cut, some lottery of life process. You were born. And you just think of the kajillions of other people who never had the opportunity, that were never born. And there are a lot of things you couldn't control. You couldn't control your hair color, your parents, your siblings, what planet you were born on, or I mean, what continent, what time dimension, and what century, and on and on. There were so many things you couldn't control. But once you're born, and on some continent on planet Earth at some point, you do have one big opportunity to exercise choice, and that is what you're going to do with the life that you were given. And that will define your impact in the time you were here. But what you ultimately realize is that your life was given to you, and you get a life by giving your life away. Giving it away to something much bigger than yourself. And we have come to refer to it as a transcendent purpose. The more your purpose is about you, the more you're going to, if you seek your own happiness, you seek your own pleasures, you seek more fame, more glory, all the things that society has labeled as markers of real success, the more you chase those, the more you begin to realize that it never ends. They are addictive in and of themselves, but they're not really sustaining you. They're not fulfilling for any length of time. And that the only real fulfillment comes in the way in which you connect to others and have an impact on their lives that will extend long beyond your own. So whether you have children or whether you have families, you know, we are part of a social climate. And I think it's so inbred in our ancestry, how our ancestors survived, that if we didn't take care of one another, if we didn't care about others, if we didn't really love and cherish family, those who went off on their own and just did their own thing and were independent, they never survived.
Thank you for explaining, Jim.
Just a notion of the importance of other people in our life, and that's how I got there.
Yes, thank you for explaining, Jim. So when I was reading about you, I learned that when you were a 16-year-old child, you were working in cemetery and crematorium. Yes. Can you share that story with us, please?
Yeah, I mean, I was 16 years of age, and I wanted to have my first car. And I'd always worked and saved as much money as I could, because I've always been kind of a car nut. I've owned all kinds of cars. I love automobiles. And so I was looking for a summer work, and I did lawns for people and everything else. And then one day I heard there was a job in a cemetery. And so I went, and it paid more money than I could make just, you know, doing people's lawns in the neighborhood or, you know, doing the odd jobs around the neighborhood. And I got 90 cents an hour, which I thought was phenomenal. And my job was to water lawns in the cemetery, and they would give you five or six big, big lots. And your job, and you were rated on how well you kept the grass green. And so you would turn on sprinklers, turn them off, and make sure there wasn't too much water, that everything got enough water, and you repaired the sprinkler heads. You made sure everything in those lots were running perfectly and that all the graves and the gravestones were managed properly. So in my hours and hours of walking through the graveyard, I would always stop and read what was inscribed on the tombstones. And I always thought, you know, even at the age of 16, I thought, you know, I wonder what I would like on my tombstone. And it actually, that thought has become part of one of the training tools we've used with a lot of our clients. And it's very powerful. But one day the supervisor approached me and said, "Jim, would you like to make more money?" And I looked at him and I said, "Absolutely." He said, "We have another job here for you. You do a nice job of watering the lots, but you would be part of a detail that actually repairs graves that have sunken in, and the cement slab may have broken, and water is kind of infiltrated into the grave, into the caskets, and you'll have to take the soil on top away. We can't bring in a backhoe because it's too destructive. We have to have a team of people clear that out, and then a special rig comes in and removes if it is a cement covering over the grave that is probably broken, and a new one that is not broken is put in place, and then you cover it up, and then the grass is put back on top." And he said, "It's quite demanding work, but you get $1.10 an hour as opposed to 90. And I said, "Oh my God." And he said, "Can you handle the hard work?" And I said, "Of course, because that means I can get my car this summer." And he said, I just warn you, there is one thing that might unnerve you a little bit. I hope this doesn't bother you. And that is that you will oftentimes see dead bodies, you know, the skeletons and floating around in the water. And I said, oh, for $1.10, that's no problem for me. And so I went on my first detail, and this is like etched in my life, in my brain. And I did write about it in my last book, Leading with Character. So I walk up, the supervisor introduces me to four of the most frightening people I have ever met in my entire life, and then drives away. And when he drives away, the team leader, this leader of this grave digging detail, comes up to me. I can't even tell you what the words he said to me. He pulled me up, and he was the most frightening, penetrating. It must have looked like Charles Manson's eyes. He was ghoulish. That's all I can say. I'm just so frightening. I had nightmares for months, maybe years sometimes. And he told me that what I'm going to see, that if I ever told anyone what I was about to see, I would be the 12th. He has already killed 11 people and buried them where they will never be found. And if that ever happens, if I tell anyone what I see, including my parents, he will kill me and he'll kill my parents. And I'm like shaking. I'm going, what is going on here? So we went to the first gravesite and they removed everything. And then all of a sudden, these three gravediggers jumped inside the grave and started robbing the grave, belt buckles, anything they could, rings, anything they could find. And I could see the body floating in the casket. And it was the most horrifying thing I'd ever seen. And when they jumped out, he pulled me up right within 2 inches of his face and said, if you mention one word of this, you will be dead. Promise you. And so will your family. So that night I went back and went right back to my supervisor and said, that's way too hard work. I can't do that. Give me back my watering job back. And he said, oh, okay. Yeah, it's hard work. So I never told my parents. I never told anyone. The guy's name was Kentucky. And I had, you know, nightmares about the guy forever. And I really do believe he probably did have 12 bodies or 11 bodies. And I would have been the 12th because he just had this sense that he was, you know, it was pure evil. And I've often thought, as I said in the book, I often thought, you know, if I had had more courage as a 16-year-old and actually went to the supervisor and said, listen, there's something really wrong here. And I'm going to, you know I'm putting myself in harm's way, but I'm going to do the right thing. I'm going to let you know what's going on. I could have prevented all those graves from being robbed that he probably did for years thereafter. And so I always wondered, you know, that was a reflection of my character. I didn't have the strength of character to really stand up and actually do what I now know would have been the right thing. And that was my two things, that evil does exist in the world. And number two, we will constantly be tested to do the right thing. And in that instance, I failed.
And what characteristic values do you embody now? What are your characteristic traits?
Well, I really value, the older and the longer I live, I value humility probably as much as anything. I've come to realize that as much as we know, we really don't know that much. And that so often when we take a position on something, human beings are, they're fantasy machines. They're fiction machines. We are so skillful at what in the research world is called motivated reasoning. We end up using our logic to convince us that whatever we're doing is the right thing. And we are really good at self-deception. And so we almost can't train, we can't trust the brains we have because the equipment is flawed. In the book, Leading with Character, I try to help the reader understand how flawed this machinery is are logical, analytical. We're not really rational human beings. We're emotional human beings that, if we really work at it, can moderate those emotions with logic and rationality. But our logical processing system, this neurological, you know, machine that we're using, can get hijacked in multiple ways. I identified 25 ways that our thinking can get, you know, really off, that there is a real world out there. And we try to make the world conform to the way we want it to be so that we don't feel guilty about the decisions we make. We feel like we did the right thing. When in fact, if you were to look at this in the life of someone else and you were purely objective, you'd come to a completely different conclusion. So, you know, we try to find happiness in self-deception. And it has to be unconscious, because we can't believe that we are deceiving ourselves purposely. But we're fiction-making machines that have to be, and the only hope we have is we rise above it and actually see what's happening and understand that we are actually, in fact, making crap up all the time. And we are prone to making what we think is reality actually distorted in ways that comfort us.
Is there a way not to create the crap in our mind?
The only answer that we have is the more educated you become and the more humble you are about the fact that you could, in fact, be wrong. Wisdom actually always starts with, this is my take on it now. I can't say with certainty that I've got this 100%, but this is how I see it now. And the more you recognize that we're working with a flawed system, whether it's moral judgments or anything else, that we have to kind of hold things tentatively until we do our work. And it's a lot of hard work. It's so much easier. I call it mental laziness with the truth, because we have, it's called conformity dynamics, or, you know, social approval dynamics, or, you know, being so many other people are saying it's true. It's just much easier to accept it because it's called groupthink. Everyone else thinks that way. I guess I will too. Rather than going out and do your own fact checking, probably the greatest challenge we have as human beings is the pursuit of truth. Reality-based, fact-based truth, and to try to build a world inside ourselves, the stories we tell to ourselves and others, is number one, grounded in the real world, not grounded in the world we would like to see, but in the world as it actually exists. And that is an everyday process that only comes when we understand how flawed the system is and how we have to hold everything tentatively. And we have to constantly pursue the truth, no matter how tough it is and how difficult it is and how much maybe pain it causes us when we realize we did things that at one point we thought were okay. Now we look at it and we realize we duped ourselves. We fooled ourselves into believing it was fine. We never felt guilty. We just did it. And we got away with it because we don't feel even the slightest remorse about it. So. Human beings are flawed, and that's why I believe humility is probably the most important dimension in being human, because the system is far from perfect.
I will come back to this thing. And you shared a story when you were working in cemetery and crematorium when you were 16. And adding up to that, you share an exercise with the participants in your training where you ask them to list 6 words that describe them when they are the best version of themselves, and then list 6 more words they believe would be inscribed on their tombstones.
Yes.
So, Jim, what would be those 6 words you would write to describe yourself as the best version?
The best version of myself?
Yes.
I don't have them in front of me. So, I mean, I've done the exercise numerous times at many different times in my life. And so, But I feel the best version of myself is when I show real, genuine humility that I don't believe I have it all. When I am truly, sincerely compassionate with other people. And I believe that for me, one of the most important words that I like myself most when I am kind. I really, kindness for me is a very, very big asset that I want to embody, and when I'm at my very best. And I also, the word integrity, that I do what I say in a way that really reflects a real perspective, and how I honor the people around me in action, whatever it is. When I say I'm going to do something, I try to make sure that I don't make false promises. And so integrity is a very important part of who I am at my best. And I like myself when I'm generous, when I feel like I recognize that so much of my life was given to me and I like to give it away. And I don't do it. I give a lot of what I have away and people have no idea where it came from. I really like that. And it just makes me feel like so much of my life was a gift, and I want to be grateful and thankful, and then represent that by being generous with others.
What are you grateful for these days?
I am most grateful for my parents, who were extraordinary people. My mother and father, you know, were highly ethical, caring, loving people, and I've come to appreciate all of the assets that they gave to me. And then I am so grateful for my three sons. They are my greatest gift, and they are my greatest teachers, Jeff, Mike, and Pat Lair. And I don't think my life could have even begun to have any depth and dimension as it currently does without them. And I have seven grandchildren, and I am, you know, very grateful for them in my life and try to help them in whatever ways I can. So, you know, I look around every day, and when I do my gratefulness list, and I have for, you know, many years, I just write down before I start my day what I am grateful for and try to mention things that I never mentioned before. So all of a sudden I'm looking at very small things, like I'm grateful at this moment to be able to have a pen where I can write these things down, and a piece of paper, because in a sense, I couldn't have put that pen together myself. I couldn't have produced this paper. Someone had to do that, and now I have it, and it enables me to complete my gratefulness list. And then the chair that I'm sitting in, and the lights that are on, and the comfort that I have, and the space that I have in my life to do that, because there are lots of people who never had that opportunity. And so I begin to realize this muscle of gratefulness for me continues to grow. And you realize that, you know, you should be grateful for everything. And gratefulness opens the door to humility. It actually opens the door to humility, because it didn't come from you. It came from somewhere else. And so it's like the two are kind of hand in glove together. If you're very grateful, you're also going to be very humble.
Do you find it easier to be grateful in your tough times?
I find it more important to be grateful in tough times, because when everything is going great and everything is good,
it's easy
to be grateful. You have a lot of gifts that are so obvious. But when you're under siege, or your loved ones are under siege, or your business is under siege, or the world is under siege, you know, sometimes you just have to step back and just count, you know, this notion is so simplistic, count your blessings, but just look at the things that are still in your life. And it really helps you modulate, you know, the kind of things that are stressing you out. You get much better perspective on them. There's a very important hormone. It's called oxytocin. And there are a number of emotions that produce this neurohormone, and compassion, kindness, gratefulness, are part of that constellation. And oxytocin, sometimes referred to as the love hormone, because it bonds the mother and the child together. But this is probably the oldest hormone on planet Earth, because it actually was released. They found traces of it in the dinosaurs, where when the dinosaur was, you know, delivered and the mother gave birth to the infant dinosaur, there was this release of oxytocin, which created a bond between the mother and the young developing animal. And that enabled the mother to take care of that child. And so that bond, you know, in some species lasts forever with the elephant species. But one of the interesting aspects of oxytocin is that it reduces some of the really powerful stress hormones like cortisol. And so that if you're very grateful, if you're very, you know, if you show a lot of compassion for others, the toxic forms of stress, where elevations in cortisol can actually really be quite harmful to one's immune system, to your health, to your happiness, they don't elevate nearly as highly. And so it's much easier to modulate our stress response when we have kind of the background template of being grateful, of being kind, of being compassionate, and being generous, and so forth. So, you know, the more I got into this space, the more I realized that all of this has its own unique biochemistry, and it interfaces with, there's this whole area of epigenetics where, you know, this neural myth, it's now called, you know, which is more important, your nature or your nurture? Well, neuroscience has pretty much debunked that myth. It's not an either or situation. It's the wrong question. The question is, how is our nature nurtured after one is born? And what can one do to bring out these propensities, these potentials? And it's kind of swimming in this very powerful neurochemistry and body chemistry, and stress is a big part of that. And oxytocin plays a critical role from the moment of birth all the way until our death. As long as we understand how oxytocin is produced, when in a soccer game, when people celebrate on a soccer field, kicking a successful ball into the net and scoring a goal, elevations in oxytocin have been measured, and that bonds the members of the team together, and they actually perform better when they celebrate like that. And we are social creatures first and foremost, and oxytocin binds us together. So there is a chemistry that actually works for us, and then there's a chemistry that actually doesn't nurture our nature, but actually ravages it if we don't understand it properly. And so it's the way our system is designed.
And Jim, I would like to ask about your book, Leading with Character. In that book, you mentioned about 10 minutes a day to a brilliant legacy. What are those 10 minutes? What can somebody do to get to a brilliant legacy in those 10 minutes?
So one of the things that at the Institute over so many years, we tested everything. What gets the greatest traction in terms of what you might call stickiness, that actually gets into this neural processing system and actually becomes habituated, actually becomes automated. In the scientific world, it's called myelinated, where you build this fatty substance called myelin and actually creates more efficiency and resiliency in these neural pathways that actually feed certain areas of the brain, neural networks. And the more we travel a certain pathway, the more those become, you know, maybe six-lane highways, and they become automated. Well, we looked at visualization. We looked at, you know, self-talk, this inner voice. We looked at everything possible in training all the people that would come there to become better and more proficient at executing under pressure. And we found of all the strategies, handwriting, cursive writing, actually had the closest connection to this area of the brain called the executive function, the prefrontal cortex. And so we started using it a lot. And leading with character is 10 minutes a day of journaling. I'm a big proponent of journaling. I've had athletes in sport that call it, you know, training logs. And we, all the athletes that we worked with over so many years, we worked with 17 number ones in the world. And they, all their coaches, and they were very familiar with training logs. And so Dan Jansen, who I worked with for 2 years, who won an Olympic gold medal and broke an Olympic record, I have all of his journals for 2 years. And he scripted those journals out with his hand, and he wrote on it things that were really important for him to etch in his brain, like things like, I love the 1,000, which he didn't love the 1,000 meter race, or 35.99, where he wanted to break the 36 second barrier. And so this leading with character is an opportunity to build maybe the most important document you will ever have in your life. And that is this, what I call your personal credo, and etch it in your brain in a way that it's always there. You don't have to look at it on a piece of paper. It just kind of surfaces when you're making important decisions in life. A single bad decision can take you off the path, can result in tragedy for years. So we have to understand, how do we make great decisions when we understand how flawed our neural processing system is, how easy it is hijacked, how prone to self-deception we are, motivated reasoning, to making up pure junk to get us through the night, and to fabricate, to just really circumvent the truth in ways that might be painful for us, but just don't allow us to really navigate effectively in life. By handwriting 10 minutes a day and filling out this journal that's accompanying the actual hardcover book, every day for the first 90 days, and then actually for another 30 days, you actually write by hand answers to the questions that begin to unearth for you your reason for being here, your ultimate mission. What are your true values? What do you want in your tombstone? What is your best self? And you put these down over, and you put them, and then you apply them. And by the end, you're in a position to create what I believe is the most important document you'll have for moving forward in your life. And it's something that wasn't given to you. You didn't inherit it. You didn't lease it. And you don't, you know, most people have no idea what they're referencing when they're making decisions about what they should or shouldn't do, about judging right from wrong or anything else. They just, they reference it, they feel it, and then they make their decision. Well, this kind of replaces that. You're still using a lot of that. You're using your logic. You're using your emotional intelligence. You're using your gut instincts, but you're putting them with and you're vetting all that through a lens that actually that you believe are the most important parameters and highest priorities in your life, and it makes a difference. And so we piloted that for 10 years, and it is not for the faint of heart. It actually is very hard to do, but it actually changes the architecture, the furniture between your ears. The processor that you're using actually becomes much better at sniffing out pure junk, at, you know, kind of fabricated nonsense that gets you through the night. And you're making better decisions. You're navigating better in life because you're dealing with the real world, and your neural processor is not fooling you as it used to.
Are you suggesting to make decisions based on the values?
So once you understand what matters most to you, what your values are, what your most important core beliefs are, the most important mission you're on in life, your connection to others, what do you want on your tombstone, what I call your ultimate address for getting home in life. When you finally get all that articulated and put down in writing, and you do it multiple times, it starts to stick in this executive function of your brain. And it helps you make, more thoughtful decisions. And it doesn't make your decision-making easier. It just gives you a little more confidence that you haven't hoodwinked yourself and made up a bunch of stuff that actually made you feel good, but actually was not reflective of what you really would be proud of if you had a judge and jury looking over this thing and you realize you actually made the right decision and you acted on it properly. There are two things in this moral system. One is you have to make the right judgment. And then once you have the right judgment, you have to act on it. And those come from different areas of the brain. They don't come from the same. So there's two asset areas that have to be worked. So, and that's what integrity is one of those that actually gets you to actually do what you know is right. Knowing is one thing, doing is another, and they both have to be part of the process of integrity.
Do you recall any bad decision in your recent years? And when you go back in those years and realize that you could have made a better decision?
I have them throughout my life. I don't know if you're human, you've made some decisions, you don't have short-term negative consequences. You realize it was a big mistake. You trusted someone that really sounded fantastic, but over the next few months, you realize they were not honest. They didn't have integrity. You allowed them into your business, and it was a tragedy. And it was a tragedy for you and maybe everyone they interacted with. And, I do the best I can at bringing in the best people. But, the system just isn't perfect. And so I've made decisions that were not fatal, but they were, if I had them to do over, I would make very different. They were not good decisions.
What would you do different?
I would not hire those people. I would not do those same things. I would take a different path. I used to track certain researchers that in their work, and then I found out they were getting results that were consistent over and over again with who was funding the research, and that's in their private institutions. And so you couldn't trust their research. And I followed a lot of their data results, and it didn't take me where I wanted to go. And today is really hard in politics is to try to judge what is the right position to take on all these issues and who's got the truth. How do you get to the truth with media just awash in all kinds of propaganda? And it's really difficult. People today have a very hard time, understanding how do you get to the truth? It takes a lot of hard work. And if you don't get the truth, you make bad decisions. And then those bad decisions, later on in life, you realize, what a bad decision that was. It was probably a bad decision for me to take that job without knowing more about it. And it was a bad decision for me not to go and, let my supervisor know what was really going on, because those graves that had been robbed probably went on for years and years.
Thank you for explaining all of it, Jim. And I would love for you to explain on mental toughness training. What are the principles and fundamentals behind mental toughness? If any of our listeners want to be mentally tough this year and in the next few years?
So it's an interesting journey for me. Again, I'm humbled by my journey. In the beginning, my first book was entitled Mental Toughness Training for Sports. And I assumed that it was, mostly mental, that we simply have to work that territory and that will prevent people from collapsing under pressure. And we just have to work our thought processes, our visualization, our imagery, rehearsals, all these things, and make it much more systematic and clean out all the bad thinking and all that kind of stuff. Well, that really was not a comprehensive enough look at it. And in fact, now I realize that its toughness is mental, it's emotional, it's physical, it's spiritual, and it's actually biomechanical if you're in a sport. If you have a second serve that always collapses under pressure, it may not be your head that needs fixing. The mechanics of your serve may be so inefficient that it doesn't allow you to be able to perform under conditions of some nervousness. Everyone gets a little nervous. If you double fault every time you're nervous, then it's probably a biomechanical inefficiency. You also can, your brain stops working properly if you don't get enough glucose, if you're not fit enough, if you're too fatigued, if you're overcome with powerful emotions like anger and frustration and jealousy and resentment. Those interfere with the processing system that help us to execute and to be able to focus on the present moment and to channel our energy like a laser to what we're doing. And so I began to realize that all of those are important, and maybe the most important is that you get the purpose right for why you're participating. Why are you doing this? Is it about money and fame, or is it about getting better and learning and becoming a more fully developed human being because of what you're going through and all the traumas and all the hard work that you're doing in the development of competency and excellence in a particular sport? And then if you become number one in the world, it's actually icing on the cake. You'll never regret being in your sport because it's helped you grow as a human being and become much more knowledgeable about yourself and much more kind of appreciative of the dynamics of how mind and body work together. So it's not just mental toughness. It's the whole system working that actually must be integrated to get extraordinary results under pressure.
You mentioned trauma. When you work with executives and sport athletes, do you work in their traumatic event for life as well, or do you not work in that area? This is just out of my curiosity.
Well, I've had the opportunity to work with athletes who've been through some very traumatic. Dan Jansen, you know, for one, on the day of his race, the sister, his sister who he cared for more than anyone, actually, he got a phone call and she died of leukemia just 3 hours before his race. And that trauma affected him because he was felt so guilty of not being there and not being able to be with her. And then that went on in his next Olympics, and it was a trauma. And so we had to work through that trauma.
How did you do that?
Well, I mean, it took a lot of just looking at everything and going through and really getting all the systems working properly and understanding that out of trauma can come out of what is sometimes referred to as post-traumatic stress can be converted into post-traumatic growth. And that's what he actually became stronger as a result of that and actually broke Olympic records because of it. Probably the best examples of this are what happens with wounded warriors or veterans who are returning from war and have lost limbs and been involved in terrible traumatic events, and their whole, and they have come, we worked with, you know, several groups of them at the Institute, the Human Performance Institute, and helping them convert that by having a whole new purpose for why they're how this could be leveraged into something for others, not for themselves, giving them a purpose, helping to understand the values, what their mission is now, to give them a whole sense of identity around this, and no one to be feeling sorry for themselves or feeling like I got bad end of the stick, but this is what you're given. What can we do with this now? And you can have a great life of meaning with that. And almost everyone has experienced trauma in their lives. Maybe it's an automobile accident and they're now becoming a professional athlete, or the death of a loved one.
How about childhood trauma?
Yeah, childhood trauma, acute childhood incidents are very powerful and can actually interfere with their ability to feel free and to be in the moment. And so, you know, it's one of the things that we're trying to, in the whole area of mental health for young athletes, is to help them understand how acute trauma in childhood can carry over, and they can actually work through a lot of that through the dynamics of sport, whether it's physical abuse or emotional abuse or child abuse or sexual abuse or whatever it is. I mean, almost everyone has some kind of acute childhood trauma that can get in the way of them just believing in themselves and actually leaving it behind and converting it into something that actually makes them stronger rather than weaker.
Jim, as we are going towards the end of the conversation, I would love to ask you, what is the impact you want to leave on this world?
It's interesting. If I really think about kind of the impact or the legacy that I would like to leave, is that sport is a fabulous teacher. It's a compressed version of life. And that if we can use the experiences of sport to learn the lessons long before they're going to be called upon, you can develop the assets that you can rely on in the arena of life that's far more unforgiving, and that mistakes are hopefully not so fatal in the early years where you're working the territory of competitive athletics for children. If I have a legacy, I'd like to be able to say that I helped build a bridge for parents, for coaches, for teachers, to understand that sport is not about just winning and being famous and all the things. I've had so many famous people in my life who regret becoming famous. They would much rather have been anonymous and developed a sense of priority and becoming the kind of person they wanted to become, and then have the success they have, but that's actually through a very special kind of lens that gives them a sense of peace about it. And so I would hope my legacy would be that I helped open the door a little wider for people to understand that sport is simply an opportunity to learn lessons about life that is, it's invaluable. It's a priceless, but you have to see it in that context. You have to understand that is the one main purpose of competitive athletics. And then if anything else happens, if you become, if you get a scholarship to college, or if you play a Division I school and become an all-star, or if you become a professional player, that's all icing on the cake. What we're really trying to push is the developmental opportunities that competitive sport affords people, gives them physical literacy, understanding the importance of physical movement, physical interaction with others on a team sport sometimes. And our body is mostly muscle, and just being able to be physical and move gracefully and to stay healthy physically, and how that paves the way for emotional fitness and mental fitness and spiritual fitness. Those are the lessons that will carry through for the rest of their life. And I hope that is the legacy that I have contributed to in some way.
You have. Thank you for your honesty, Jim. And people can find you at your website, www.jim-lehr.com, jim-lehr.com. Is there any other resource or anything else you would like listeners to find more about you?
No, I think I'm on LinkedIn. I have most of my, you know, all the videos I have and all the podcasts I do, I post on LinkedIn. And you're welcome to look at all those. And then on my website, jim-lehr.com. And I'm hoping that my work and my books will contribute in some way to your understanding that we're all learning and none of us have got it all right. We're trying to piece it together.
Very, very true. And we will put everything in the show notes. Jim, last but not the least, is there anything else I should have asked you and I did not ask you?
Well, I can't think of anything except maybe I always feel privileged to be able to express what I believe are the things that I've learned. And I'm just hoping that the questions you've asked me, including this last question, will stir others to kind of get a little bit more into this space and understand that we are imperfect and we're going to have to work pretty hard to override some of the deficiencies in the system so we, in fact, will have a great life and we can get home. Truly get home, whatever that means to everyone.
Thank you so much. And I would like to wrap up this conversation by one of your quote from your amazing book, The Power of Full Engagement. Managing energy, not time, is the key to high performance and personal renewal. So thank you so much, Jim, for this amazing, beautiful conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nishant. Thank you very much. much for the opportunity, and I wish you all the best in this year.
Thank you, and you too. This episode is brought to you by my own Friday newsletter. Every Friday, I share a newsletter which describes my new learnings. And these learnings can be in the form of new books I'm reading, different podcasts, and blogs I'm exploring to learn new topics such as trauma healing, relationships, mindfulness, psychology, and much, much more. You can find the newsletter link at my website, https://nishantgarg.me, nishantgarg.me. Once again, nishantgarg.me. And thank you so much for listening to this show. Thank you for listening to this podcast episode today. If you did enjoy this, please subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, or you can visit https://nishantgarg.me. nishantgarg.me. You can also share this episode with your loved ones to help them live a fulfilled life. You are not alone in this journey. We all struggle in life. There is no shame in talking about it. I go through my highs and lows. I get depressed, and these practices help me in living a resilient life. You can also do this. You got this. Don't judge yourself. You are doing the best you can. And thank you so much again.